In 1800, a newborn child could expect to live just 35 years. Today, that number has doubled. We've each been gifted roughly 20,000 extra days, an entire second life that our ancestors never knew. Yet we barely notice this miracle. We complain about aging, fear death at 70, and take for granted that most children will survive to adulthood. But this wasn't inevitable. For 10,000 years, human life expectancy remained trapped beneath an invisible ceiling. One-third of children died before reaching adulthood, whether they lived in ancient Rome or medieval London, in agricultural villages or hunter-gatherer bands. What shattered this ancient pattern? The answer isn't what you'd expect. It wasn't brilliant doctors or lone scientific geniuses. Instead, it was an unlikely network of activists, bureaucrats, journalists, and ordinary people who refused to accept that early death was humanity's fate. Smallpox killed more people than all wars combined. Between 1650 and 1750, it claimed over 15% of deaths in some European cities, with 90% of victims under age 10. Survivors faced scarring and blindness. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, an aristocrat disfigured by the disease, became an unlikely hero. In Turkey, she observed variolation, deliberately exposing people to mild smallpox to create immunity. Though it carried a 2% death risk, this beat the 25% childhood mortality rate. She had her son inoculated, making him the first British citizen to undergo the procedure. Her advocacy convinced the royal family to follow, creating a social tipping point. The revelation. Centuries before scientists understood immunology, Asian healers had discovered that controlled disease exposure could save lives. Without knowing about antibodies or T cells, they'd grasped the same principle behind today's cancer immunotherapies. In September 1854, cholera devastated London's Soho neighborhood, killing victims within hours. Dr. John Snow suspected contaminated water, not bad air, was the culprit. He mapped every death, revealing a cluster around Broad Street's water pump. Authorities removed the pump handle, and infections plummeted. But Snow didn't work alone. William Farr's systematic death records, tracking age, occupation, and location, provided crucial data. Local vicar Henry Whitehead, initially skeptical, discovered patient zero, baby Lewis at 40 Broad Street, whose waste had seeped into the well through a decaying brick wall. This collaboration reveals something vital about progress. We celebrate individual genius, but breakthroughs emerge from networks. Snow needed Farr's data infrastructure and Whitehead's local knowledge. Later, Joseph Bazalgette's massive sewer system, 300 million bricks across 82 miles, permanently separated London's waste from water, ending cholera's terror. By the 1840s, over half of New York City's deaths were infants and young children. One major culprit? Milk. As Manhattan's farmland vanished, dairy producers partnered with distilleries, feeding cows swill, boiling waste from whiskey production. Thousands of cows were crammed into urban stalls, tied in place their entire lives, fed slop that caused ulcerated sores and made their teeth fall out. The resulting bluish, foul milk was doctored with chalk, flour, and eggs, then sold as pure country milk. Journalist Frank Leslie's shocking 1858 exposé ended the swill milk era, but dangers persisted. Louis Pasteur discovered in 1865 that heating liquids to 130 degrees prevented spoilage, yet pasteurization didn't become standard until 1950, 50 years later. Science alone doesn't change the world. You also need struggle. Nathan Strauss, a department store owner who'd lost two children to disease, opened milk depots, selling pasteurized milk below cost in poor neighborhoods. His persistent advocacy, attracting even President Roosevelt's attention, made pasteurized milk mandatory in major cities by the 1920s. Between 1900 and 1930, infant mortality plummeted 62%. Harvard researchers determined chemical interventions, like pasteurization, accounted for over two-thirds of this improvement. In 1937, the S.E. Massengill Company rushed Elixir sulfanilamide to market, a raspberry-flavored strep throat treatment for children. Their chemist dissolved the medicine in diethylene glycol, essentially antifreeze, added flavoring, and shipped 240 gallons nationwide. Within weeks, 105 people died from kidney failure. Agriculture Secretary Henry Wallace revealed a shocking truth. The elixir was tested for flavor, but not for its effect on human life. This exposed a fundamental problem. Pharmaceutical companies had no legal obligation to create safe medicines. The tragedy triggered the 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, empowering the FDA to investigate drug safety. Decades later, FDA reviewer Francis Oldham Kelsey received an application for thalidomide, a morning sickness treatment approved in over 40 countries. When she discovered reports of nerve damage, she grew concerned about fetal effects. Her instincts proved correct. Thalidomide caused over 10,000 severe birth defects worldwide, but Kelsey's scrutiny limited American cases to a handful. The scandal led to 1962 amendments requiring pharmaceutical companies to prove both safety and efficacy. Alexander Fleming's 1928 discovery of penicillin is legendary, but transforming it into a miracle drug required an international network. Fleming noticed mold-killing bacteria, but couldn't produce penicillin in useful quantities. His discovery sat dormant until World War II created urgent demand. Oxford scientists Howard Florey and Ernst Chain rediscovered Fleming's neglected paper, and colleague Norman Heatley engineered a contraption to transform moldy broth into functional penicillin. Their first patient was policeman Albert Alexander, whose rose thorn scratch became catastrophically infected. On February 12, 1941, he received his first dose. Within hours, his fever normalized and infection cleared. When their limited supply ran out after 2 weeks, his infection returned. He died March 15th. To solve production, Florey turned to America. Bacteriologist Mary Hunt examined rotting produce in grocery stores, searching for productive molds. Her cantaloupe discovery revolutionized production. Nearly every penicillin strain today descends from Hunt's find. By D-Day 1944, Allied troops carried penicillin onto Normandy's beaches. The impact was staggering. Tuberculosis fell from America's third leading cause of death to outside the top 50. The gap between wealthy and developing nations has narrowed dramatically. Sweden took 150 years to reduce childhood mortality from 30% to under 1%. South Korea did it in 45. India's life expectancy jumped from 35 after World War II to over 70 today. Yet in low-income countries, waterborne diseases remain the second leading cause of death. The Gates Foundation's off-grid toilet prototype offers hope, a closed-loop system burning waste as fuel and disinfecting water for just 5 cents daily. Scientists are exploring gene drive technology to eliminate malaria by reducing mosquito populations or making them resistant to the parasite. Some researchers now challenge whether life must end at all. Japanese biologist Shinya Yamanaka identified 4 genes that reset the aging clock, enabling scientists to engineer mice living 30% longer. Yet our greatest threat may come from this very triumph. If life expectancy declines, the culprit will likely be environmental impact from billions living in industrialized societies. Bola Island embodies both achievement and crisis. 4 decades ago, it witnessed smallpox eradication. Today, large stretches have vanished beneath rising seas. The island may disappear by 2079, when descendants celebrate smallpox eradication centennial. Will that victory be the first in a long line of conquered threats? Or will those achievements wash away with an actual tide?